there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Shouldn't you be at work?
And Love. Oh, and Love, he's got a real chance now. Peter and Love.
John Walk. We'll take the penalty. Up goes Dion Dublin.
An own goal from Ruddock.
Ball might break here for Kiwabia.
Panister and Bruce in the queue again.
Bruce scores.
Goal leg. Hit leg. Hit leg over the top. It's back now.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, no. Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? It is Series 9. I'm Chris Gold. Joining me as always, Josh Whittaker.
Hello.
And here he is. I haven't got an intro for him, but he's here anyway. It's Michael Mard.
Hello.
Welcome back. I knew I said I was going to be away, but I'll be away further down the line now. I think the way we should play this series is just be excited about who the lineup's going to be for the final few episodes on a week-to-week basis. For instance, today we have an interview with the amazing Nick Hancock, which was very exciting, obviously a very on-point guest for us. And just so you know, Michael wasn't there for the interview. It isn't that Michael was absolutely so intimidated by Nick Hancock that he couldn't get a word in. Right, now, well, should we start with the 90 o'clock news, Chris?
Let's go for it.
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10 with Chris Scull.
A listener shares referee Graham Barber's timeline and Chris Sutton makes astonishing decision.
I know the Chris Sutton one already.
Yeah, I can't believe it. I mean, yeah. This is astonishing.
Let's start with Graham Barber. I don't really know much about Graham Barber.
I can't really picture Graham Barber. The name rings a bell. Let me just have a look at what he looks like. Do you remember what Graham Barber looks like, Michael?
No, I can't. No mental image at all.
But thank you to Andrew Watt, who sent us through this astonishing revelation.
Oh, yeah, I recognise him.
Andrew Watt has said he recently re-listened to the Dermot Gallagher episode where we were talking about the day of a ref. And then he's watching a replay of Match of the Day from 96-97. The main game he's watching highlights of is Newcastle-Arsenal. And Tony Gubber mentions in passing that referee Graham Barber got to the Newcastle-Arsenal game at 10 a.m. for a 3 p.m. kickoff. 5 hours beforehand.
Oh, absolutely.
What are you doing?
You don't want that, do you?
What? There's nothing to do.
So what's he doing with his time?
Yeah, exactly. What are you doing? You only really need to be there an hour, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before at a push. You run out, check the goal, do a little jog, you're good to go. 5 hours.
Well, the only thing would be if it was a really bad weather or pitch and you wanted to get in ahead of the kind of game on it. Do you know what I mean?
Astonishing. But I've put this story second. It's clearly our main story, really. Chris Sutton, on the 7th of November, put his Christmas tree up.
That is insane.
The 7th of November. What is he thinking?
Is it a real tree?
It looks to be a fake tree. I'm pleased to announce.
Yeah.
But he also says, Chris Sutton says as by way of explanation, there was not his decision. He says, not my call this, Santa. And the Christmas tree already out. We are better than this, ...
So he's taken a photo of himself with Santa and his daughter in front of this fake tree. He's also then not put the photo up. He's then screen grabbed the photo from his own camera roll showing how low his battery is. That is mad. November the 7th.
Yeah. And do you know what? Another peculiar thing about this is he's got like a 4.5-foot Santa.
And also, the picture's taken in almost a complete dark. It's such a bleak picture.
No decorations on the tree. Not even a name. And the tree is kind of buckling under a beam at the top. The tree doesn't have enough space.
In the house. Do you think you'd like Chris Sutton as your dad? Like, you know, like, because he's quite funny, isn't he? And he's quite kind of grumpy, but in a kind of comedy way. Do you think Chris Sutton would be quite a fun dad to have?
Yeah, I think he would. I think there's definitely an element of him creating the on-screen persona. And everything he says, even that sort of sternness, there is a playful glint in his eye.
Yeah, I like him. I think
this is it's a bit of fun, isn't it? He knows it's crazy early. But to be fair, he's getting a bit of traction with it.
Exactly. Enjoy yourself, Chris. Enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
Now, can we begin the postbags? We've got so much to get through.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
Further to... this is from Ben Thurston. Hello. Further to our conversations about the pools panels, I wonder if you turned your attention to spot the ball. My understanding of this was that, as it is illegal to bet on the event that has already taken place, what you're actually trying to do is not identify the position of the ball, but to replicate the guess of a panel of experts. The following extract is from a Guardian article from January 15th. At the time, no one had won the jackpot in over 10 years. This is the extract. Actually, what players are trying to do each week is not identify the factually correct whereabouts of the ball, but the whereabouts of a fictional ball determined by a mini-conference between two former players. So Liverpool's Ian Callaghan and David Sadler of Manchester United. How do they do that? Unfortunately, Callaghan answers the phone only to say that he doesn't want to talk and he doesn't have 5 minutes. Presumably, they don't actually meet up to decide. So, not only is there a pools panel and a dubious goals panel, but there is a spot the ball panel as well.
This is blowing my mind.
Yeah, I knew that. So they're just... you're not guessing where the ball actually is. You're guessing where someone thought the ball would be.
So, according to this article, Ian Penrose, chief executive of Sports Tech, says they do meet up every Saturday. They study a photo with the ball taken away. They sit and deliberate and decide where the centre of the ball should be, and that's then marked with a pin. Deliberations take up to an hour. The process is unchanged in more than two decades. There you go. Matt Hamilton writes, "Hi, guys. Been listening to your many discussions of how Peter Shilton seemed to wait till the ball had gone in before choosing which way to go. But I think I've stumbled across a goalkeeper with an even worse technique. I was recently watching the 1982 World Cup semi-final that became the first World Cup match to go to penalties. French goalkeeper Jean-Luc Attori faced 6 penalties. He only dived for 1, and that was after the ball hit him. His technique seemed to consist of him staggering around the penalty area like a drunk, hoping he would somehow walk into the ball. Imagine only diving once. So he's not dived. He stayed, stood.
Is he moving, though? Because there's a difference between staying static and the hope that one of them will be sort of hit down the middle or close enough to you, or doing that kind of Bruce Grobbelaar kind of like moving along the line in the hope that you might put them off.
Well, so what's the other option? Is that he's running to the side rather than diving? That wouldn't seem like the right thing to do, would it?
No, but do you know what I mean? Like, if he's constantly sort of taking a few steps either way, at some point the penalty taker has to take that penalty. And they've got the choice of going where they've chosen to go before his movement, or waiting for him, a bit like an arcade game, and going, okay, he's moved far enough to the left now, I'm going to go to the right, which feels
like... Do you think if you were allowed... I can't remember how the rules work. If you're allowed to move left and right on the line, do you think constantly moving side to side would be an advantage or a mistake? Like, if a goalie was running from one post to the other, and I suppose you're trying to time it like you say in a computer game, trying to shoot at the right point.
I'd be interested to see it. I feel like there might be a differential in there because it is new and it is different. And I think certain players, they're already quite nervous, the psychology of it. They might overcompensate and shoot a bit further to the right, for instance, and they might normally and shank it or put it wide.
Are you constantly facing forward and kind of sidestepping, or are you turning 90 degrees and pegging it between across. The posts?
I think you need to be sidestepping. I think you need to be able to
You're not going to get much of a pace up there, are you? Like, the pace is going to be slow enough that it's like, when you're on one side, you've got no chance of getting to the other. But if you just turn 90 degrees and are pegging it as hard as you can between the posts, suddenly it's a game changer.
I think the turning axis slows you down as well. And also, you're not committed to go to crab and sidestep all the way to each post. You could go a step and fake them and come back the other way.
Here's an idea, right? So you start and your position is a sprinter's kind of, you know, like at the start of the 100 metres, using one of the posts for your heel, right, to push off. So the whole goal is at the mercy, and you're in the corner, braced like a sprinter. And as the person runs up, you're gonna pounce off and you're gonna dive across the goal completely. And he's got to judge where would you position that kick? I think that'd be a difficult thing to play against.
I think you're right. I think that would be very unsafe. You wouldn't want to be the first kicker up against that technique, would you? Like, by the fifth one, you'd be like, okay, I've got a measure of this. I think the instinct is to go as far away as possible from the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But also, if he's started with any kind of momentum going forward, there's absolutely no way he can stop, turn around and respond if you've gone behind him. But also, I guess there'd have to be a sense that once a kicker starts his run-up, he can't do one of those sort of like weird Jorginho staggered ones. There's a sort of like, once the flag, you know, like a drag race, once someone drops the flag, you're both going until the ball has been kicked.
But you know, there is kind of a precedent, isn't there? Because like Bruce Grobbelaar did the spaghetti legs in the European Cup final. Like, that at the time was seen as really innovative and really consequential in terms of, was it Roma they played? Like, in terms of all those penalties that were missed. So, but mate, there's something in this. There is something in this. I think if you could innovate on the big stage, imagine the Euro final against Italy. Jordan Pickford is pegging it between the posts. You're going to be completely discombobulated as the penalty taker, aren't you?
So imagine this is, we've gone back in time, we're at the Euros, it's the finals, it's a penalty shootout. We're there in the fan park watching this. And Jordan Pickford starts doing that. Like, what's going through your mind?
I would honestly think he'd had such a good tournament. I was like,
this is brilliant. His normal technique. He saved. The problem with it is, if you do that as a goalkeeper, the goalkeeper can't be the villain, except at the 1990 World Cup semi-final. But the goalkeeper can't be the villain. So if the goalkeeper was to do that, I feel like if it failed, they'd get a lot of flack.
But imagine if he saves the first one. Imagine watching the heads go of the Italians in the semicircle.
Because also, you could do it from different posts. You wouldn't necessarily need to go left to right every time.
And also, if you're doing it for the first two, and on the third one you're static, you'll be like, what's going on now?
What about if you held onto the crossbar and kind of swung yourself left and right?
Like monkeys using the crossbar, like monkey bars.
Do you need to be on the line physically, or could Jordan Pickford, if he wanted, be stood on top of the crossbar? Which is, he's on the line directly.
He's on the line.
Yeah, he's on the line. And then his aim is to jump down the right. So the momentum of his fall.
I'm going to say that's probably the least effective of all the suggestions.
But what if he's like, you know, like how runners start for that 100 metres? They get down on like, they kneel down in the blocks. He's doing that, but he's in the very back corner of the net. So you're like, he's going to come charging out, but it's on what direction? Like, do you go for the far post? That appears like he's getting ready to sprint there. So like...
Yeah. Yeah, which direction he's charging at. Yeah.
Hey, it could work. It could work.
Okay, well, I should just end this correspondence with a very simple thing. Do you want to see... Do you remember when England toured Australia in 1991? I don't know if you remember this. They did some friendlies in 1991. Do you want to see a picture, a publicity picture from it? Do you like that?
Oh, wow.
What can you see there?
So that is Stuart Pearce sporting an incredible haircut. I had that haircut once as a kid, but it's because my mum couldn't afford it to take us to the hairdresser, so she just put a bowl on my head and just cut round the edges of the bowl.
Well, Stuart Pearce has the haircut of, you're right, of a school child, but no one's willing to say that to him.
Yeah. And he is stood next to Des Walker in what I assume are sort of official England tracksuits.
They don't look very official, do they?
They don't. They look like the sort of...
They look like
Littlewood's catalogue. Shell suit tracksuits. And Stuart Pearce, the key detail is Stuart Pearce is cradling a kangaroo like a baby.
It's a beautiful picture, isn't it?
I didn't even spot the kangaroo. It blended into the tracksuit top.
What did you think the picture was? Just him. You didn't spot the kangaroo.
I was like, you talking about his hair. The kangaroo blends seamlessly into the tracksuit top.
I'm not sure it does.
No, if someone said, "What's that picture of?" I would definitely see the kangaroo.
But do you know where? Have you ever seen that? Sometimes they paint warships with this triangular like pattern that's not dissimilar to this one on this tracksuit, because apparently it's really difficult to pick up.
Yeah. It's a bit like the Manchester United third kit.
And I never thought, well, that doesn't work. Here is the evidence. I didn't see a kangaroo amongst this pattern.
Oh well, there we go.
We'll get that on our Instagram.
If you want to get in touch with us, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
Now, a legend of 90s football, if you do like the 90s, then Chris Skull, you have a book out about 90s football called what?
Can We Not Knock It? It's all in there. Lots of different games from the 90s that were looked at. Czech Republic once played Bamba Bridge in a Euro 96 warm-up. Read all about it. You can get a copy at canwenotknockit.com.
And if you like 90s culture, and frankly, why wouldn't you? Surely the dream Christmas present is that compacted into one present, or wrapped separately, with my book, Watching Neighbours Twice a Day, which is a journey through the 90s told through the TV shows we watched. Go and buy both of them. Here is a man who bestrode 90s television. Room 101, They Think It's All Over, Football Nightmares, The Outsiders, a documentary about following Iran at France 98. And of course, throughout it, was a huge fan of Stoke City, with a great story about being slammed by Stanley Matthews. This was a lovely chat with the brilliant Nick Hancock.
Today's guest is very much one of our dream guests. In the 90s, he combined hosting the iconic comedy panel show They Think It's All Over with dominating the VHS charts with his Football Nightmare series. It's our pleasure to welcome to Quickly Kevin, TV Titan and Stoke City fan, Nick Hancock.
How are you, Nick?
Very good, thank you very much. Just the ticket, yeah. Stoke not doing too badly, so that always helps. Pretty positive.
Are you emotionally involved? How emotionally involved do you get in Stoke City?
Yeah, less than I used to. I mean, I'll be honest, since I've had children, not that I love my children more than I love Stoke. That's clearly not the case. It's confused things a little bit. I do get involved, but not in the same way that, you know, when you go to every single game and you live and breathe it and, you know, all you do, the moment one game finishes, pardon me, is plan the next one. And not that bad, but, you know, it still upsets me when they do badly, which is nearly all the time.
In the 90s was the kind of glut of the suddenly of the football fan, of the comedian or celebrity that be associated clearly with a club, and you were Stoke. It felt like you were one of the ones that was the most kind of passionate about your club.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are different sorts of ways that worked, aren't there? Because first and foremost, you know, before 1990 and all that stuff, virtually nobody was willing to be associated with it. Yeah. So you know, I was not a lone voice, but there are a lot of dilettantes out there. And I always say that if you meet somebody and they say they support club, you know within 2 or 3 minutes if they support the club to the same level that you support the club.
Yeah.
You can tell easily.
Yeah.
Being Stoke's number one fan in the 90s, I'd say, what benefit did you see of that?
Oh, God, none. No, absolutely not. Because I used to just go with my mates the same way I always had. And of course, in the 90s, you know, the whole sort of executive box type thing, it only just kind of started. And it would have, being a Stoke fan, it would have seemed incredibly poncy to have done it. So not really. In fact, the only time I got to touch the hem of the coats of the influential people was when we won the Autoglass in 1992. And they... I'd just like to say we won it again in 1999. You know what I mean? It was our decade. They asked me to do a speech at the dinner afterwards.
Oh, wow. Now,
Josh, I don't know whether you've ever done a speech for professional sports.
No, I wouldn't want to.
Don't do it. You know, the comedian Bob Mills was asked to do cabaret for the England squad.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, a bit before a game, and died so badly he pretended to faint. He did, and he was sort of carried out. So, of course, similarly, I can tell that story because this is what happened to me. So I'm starting with the same sort of jokes I'd do if it was like my local football club, you know, taking the mickey out of them, saying, you know, that they're slow or they're this or they're that or they're the other. And of course, all professional footballers think that it's just bad luck that they're not, you know, the Ballon d'Or winner.
Yeah.
That there's no acceptance that possibly there's a grey area between, you know it's just a sort of an order. Anyway, so clearly all these jokes went down very, very badly. And then I just had a little hand on my shoulder, and the bloke sitting next to me. And he said, I think you better sit down, son. And but wait. And the bloke sitting next to me was Sir Stanley Matthews.
Oh, wow. Oh, so, no.
You know, very polite booing off, but by a peer of the realm.
Oh, wow.
So that
and did that ruin your day? You'd won the auto.
Did it ruin my day? I think about it constantly. I ended up, first of all, what happened is I did sit down and it sort of ended.
Yeah.
And then players came one by one to threaten me for the things I'd said to them, including the quite frightening Mick Kennedy, who was a member of that sort of incredible Portsmouth side with Noel Blake and all those sort of people. Yeah. And he was famous, you know, hard, you know, and lots and lots and lots of threats and anger. And I, you know, I ended up writing a letter to the club, to the players, and saying, I can't.
So can you not think about, maybe the ruin the day was the wrong phrase. Maybe I should put it this way. Can you not think about the 1992 Autoglass win with anything other than regret?
No, it's like going to see the total eclipse of the sun and looking straight at it. All I can remember is that blinding sense of failure and embarrassment and regret. No, that's all I see. That's all I see.
Oh, mate.
Yeah. You know, I smoked for quite a long time because they said that, you know, each cigarette takes a minute off your life. And I was hoping that I could choose the minutes that I could take off my life and I could go back to 1992 and take those minutes out of my life. So, yeah, that was the only privilege I had, the privilege to ruin my sense of self-esteem. Mate. Yeah.
You kind of alluded to the fact that in the 80s that being a football fan was very frowned upon. In the 90s it suddenly became the ultimate accessory kind of thing. And I suppose, do you know, we hadn't written this down, but this just popped into my head. The defining thing that did that maybe is Italia 90. And you, of course, were in one of the defining texts of Italia 90, which was An Evening with Gary Lineker.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, An Evening with Gary Lineker was a play about watching the semi-final of the World Cup in a hotel in Mallorca. And Caroline Quentin was in it, and I was in it, Chris England was in it, and it was written by Arthur Smith and Chris England. And it wasn't a great leap to write this because I watched the semi-final of the 1990 World Cup in a hotel in Mallorca with Caroline Quentin, Arthur Smith, Chris England, and strangely enough, Bob Mills. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah. And indeed, Graham Souness, who was not in the same room, but was at the same hotel.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
This is like a seminal Sex Pistols gig, isn't it?
Kind of. Yeah, yeah. But of course, what then happened was we did the play in the West End, and it was great. It was a lovely thing to do because it was just your mates. And if the play gets written, you do it in a tiny hall somewhere, and it ends up in the West End, and it's written by your friends, and I get to play a Stoke fan. So it was absolutely wonderful. And then before they went to Sweden, because, of course, it was the one where Lineker got taken off, yeah, before they went there, the whole squad came to watch it, so in the West End. So that was quite nice. But Stuart Pearce wasn't there. And Chris, who wrote it, told me a great story about when it went on tour and they had a new cast, they did it in... they did it in Nottingham. Stuart Pearce came along to watch it. And at the end, there's a dream sequence where the penalties are being taken. And of course, they're going, and who's this? Who's it? It's Pearce. It's Pearce stepping up to the ball. And of course, everybody in the theatre just turns around and looks at Stuart Pearce. And in the play, Pearce scores. And we go, and it's there, Pearce has scored. And Stuart Pearce stood up and went, yes! Yes! In the theatre, which is very
crazy. Oh, wow.
Because we normally start by saying, have you met a 90s footballer? But obviously with you, Stanley Matthews is not a 90s footballer in his 90s, maybe. But was there a kind of crossover between the comedy and the football world at that time?
No, not really, no. I mean, of course, it was easier to meet players then anyway, because, you know, they might do something other than sit at home playing, you know, Call of Duty. So, you know, there's half a chance you might see them somewhere. The ones that I met mostly were once they think it's all over, it started, because they would come on. Actually, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to persuade professional sportsmen, any professional sportsman, but especially footballers, to come on a show like that, because they live in a dressing room mentality, which means they're used to having the mickey taken out of them, but they also don't ever want to put their head above the parapet because then you're the one that gets, oh, you did that on that program, you skipped. So, but we had some great people and there were some very funny people around. So yeah, I mean, that was really lucky. It was just as a sports fan, what's not to like, you know, to meet all of your heroes and then be really rude to them.
Well, I was thinking about that because your stick was to be quite acerbic, a lot of mickey taking, but as you say, you know, you're relying on them getting the joke. Did it always come off, or did anyone come up to you afterwards?
What do you mean, as in like Mick Kennedy? Will Carling offered me out once. Well, it was more of a, you don't want to be saying that again, or you might find that something bad will happen to you type thing, which is very funny. But mostly they do get the joke. They live in this incredible, predominantly male world where they get very, very bored and they just take the mickey out of each other, and dead pigs in each other's lockers and stuff like that. So if we go beyond the practical joke, they're kind of fine with it. And that was a great thing about having Lineker and Gow was, if you're taking the piss out of probably the most famous footballer in the country at the time and probably the finest cricketer in the country at the time, then they're not really in a position to complain if you're taking the mickey out of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If somebody at the very top
can
say, this is fine, that it kind of helps.
Because I remember at the time, like, you were really in awe, not so much like on screen, but I remember in interviews and stuff, you David Gow was like your favourite
sportsman.
Oh,
yeah.
Because you're a huge cricket fan as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And so how quickly does David Gow stop being the person that I adored who was on the cricket pitch and become a kind of work colleague almost? Do you know what I mean? Or is he always David Gower?
I think almost immediately, to tell you the honest truth. Because the good thing about that, and I won't get into this too much, it's not something I've really thought about, but in a sense, they're coming into your world.
Yeah.
So you're making them feel comfortable about what's going on. Not just the world of comedy, but the world of television to a large extent, the world of a panel show. So it's not like me going and having a net with him, you know what I mean? or playing five-a-side with Gary. It's not like that.
Would watch it, though. I would watch that.
And I would do it.
Let's talk about Stoke. So...
Yeah.
Because I think actually that is one of the things. It's because you were so obviously a bona fide, a proper sports fan. I think that buys you a lot more as well. What were your earliest memories? You were born in 1962, so your earliest memories of supporting Stoke must be early 70s, would they be?
Yeah, very late 60s, early 70s. 69, 70 was the first season I went to a game. And I was thinking about this the other day, actually. I hadn't really probably seen that much football. There wasn't very much football on television. You know, it wasn't like you could have that sort of be blooded in your own home. You could warm up for going to a game by watching lots of football.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It worked like that. Generally, your first experience was just rocking up. And, you know, I just remember my dad, I had my mate Phil around, and my dad said, what do you boys want to do today? Stoker at home, or we could go conker collecting at Shavington Gardens. I seem to remember the two options. And it's cost me a lot of money, but I chose to go to Stoke. And I've never collected a conker since.
But there's a parallel world where you're one of the foremost conker collectors in.
Absolutely.
Doing a conker podcast right now.
Yeah.
So the late 60s is pretty good for Stoke. Did you see Gordon Banks play? He was signed that time.
Now Gordon signed in 66, 67. I saw a lot of Gordon Banks. And in fact, I went to his last ever game, which clearly I didn't know was going to be his last ever game because he had a car crash the next day.
Oh, God.
And it was away at Liverpool, which was not something I would normally probably have done at that age because I'd only been about 10, 11, 12 maybe. And my dad said, come on, we'll go to Anfield to watch Stoke. And and tragically, next day he had his accident. So I got to see Gordon Banks, you know, and Jimmy Greenough, and Dennis Smith, and Alan Hudson, and those were all the players that were around at that time.
What's like the early days supporting Stoke? Was it very much like everyone would talk about Stanley Matthews? He played on until he was 50, but I think you would have just missed the tail end of his leg.
Yeah, he played until he was 51. In 1965, and of course he may well have played on another 5 years, but substitutes hadn't been brought in at that stage.
Right.
So he was picked. He had to play 90 minutes, you know. so you can imagine. You say, well, we'll give Stan another couple of years. He can come on. He can come on for 20 minutes at the end, you know.
Yeah.
Because actually, the interesting thing about that was when Stan retired, we immediately bought Gordon Banks. And the reason was we'd made so much money out of playing friendlies because Stan played for us. You know, we were forever being asked to go to Real Madrid and Barcelona. And then we got Gordon Banks. And again, we were welcome in houses we should really have been welcome in.
So it's like when the kind of, you know, you see those news stories now about a club who've signed a Chinese player in the hope that it'll kind of break the Far East for them.
Banks. Yes. Well, I suppose kind of. You know, Stan was from Stoke, so there was more of a logic to it. I think this was discovered rather than being the plan.
Yes,
But it worked, yeah.
What was the match-going atmosphere like? What was the Victoria Ground like when you first...
Victoria Ground, we had a great big open end, which you had home fans and away fans in. Until about 10 minutes after kickoff. And then there's a big booth in there. The building stand, which was the new...
Shouldn't you be at work?
And Love. Oh, and Love, he's got a real chance now. Peter and Love.
John Walk will take the penalty. Up goes Dion Dublin.
Unknown goal from Ruddock.
Ball might break here for Kiwabia.
Panister and Bruce in the queue again.
Bruce scores!
Hit leg over the top. Now.
Now you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly? Yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hatton.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly, Kevin. Will he score? It is Series 9. I'm Chris Skoll. Joining me, as always, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And here he is. I haven't got an intro for him, but he's here anyway. It's Michael Mard.
Hello.
Welcome back. I knew I said I was going to be away, but I'll be away further down the line now. I think the way we should play this series is just be excited about who the lineup's going to be for the final few episodes on a week-to-week basis. For instance, today we have an interview with the amazing Nick Hancock, which was very exciting. Obviously a very on-point guest for us. And just so you know, Michael wasn't there for the interview. It isn't that Michael was absolutely so intimidated by Nick Hancock that he couldn't get a word in. Right, now, well, should we start with the 90 o'clock news, Chris?
Let's go for it.
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10, with
Chris Skull.
A listener shares referee Graham Barber's timeline, and Chris Sutton makes astonishing decision.
I know the Chris Sutton one already.
I can't believe it. I mean, yeah. This is astonishing.
Let's start with Graham Barber. I don't really know much about Graham Barber.
I can't really picture Graham Barber. The name rings a bell. Let me just have a look at what he looks like. Do you remember what Graham Barber looks like, Michael?
No, I can't. No mental image at all.
But thank you to Andrew Watt, who sent us through this astonishing revelation.
Oh, yeah, I recognise him.
Andrew Watt has said he recently re-listened to the Dermot Gallagher episode where we were talking about the day of a ref. And then he's watching a replay of Match of the Day from 96-97. The main game he's watching highlights of is Newcastle-Arsenal. And Tony Gubber mentions in passing that referee Graham Barber got to the Newcastle-Arsenal game at 10 a.m. for a 3 p.m. kickoff. Five hours beforehand.
Oh, absolutely.
What are you doing?
You don't want that, do you?
What? There's nothing to do.
So what's he doing with his time?
Yeah, exactly. What are you doing? You only really need to be there an hour, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before at a push. When you run out, check the goal, do a little jog, you're good to go. 5 hours.
Well, the only thing would be if it was a really bad weather or pitch and you wanted to get in ahead of the kind of...
Yeah.
Game on it. Do you know what I mean?
Astonishing. But I've put this story second. It's clearly our main story, really. Chris Sutton,
yeah,
on the 7th of November, put his Christmas tree up.
That is insane.
The 7th of November. What is he thinking?
Is it a real tree?
It looks to be a fake tree, I'm pleased to announce.
Yeah.
But he also says, Chris Sutton says as by way of explanation, there was not his decision. He says, not my call this, Santa. And the Christmas tree already out. We are better than this, ...
So he's taken a photo of himself with Santa and his daughter in front of this fake tree. He's also then not put the photo up. He's then screen grabbed the photo from his own camera roll, showing how low his battery is. That is mad. November the 7th.
Yeah. And do you know what? Another peculiar thing about this is he's got like a 4.5 foot Santa.
And also, the picture is taken in almost a complete dark. It's such a bleak picture.
No decorations on the tree, not even a name. And the tree is kind of buckling under a beam at the top. The tree doesn't have enough space.
In the house. Do you think you'd like Chris Sutton as your dad? Like, you know, like, because he's quite funny, isn't he? And he's quite kind of grumpy, but in a kind of comedy way. Do you think Chris Sutton would be quite a fun dad to have?
Yeah, I think he would. I think there's definitely an element of him creating the on-screen persona. And everything he says, even that sort of sternness, there is a playful glint in his eye.
Yeah, I like him. I think
this is it's a bit of fun, isn't it? He knows it's crazy early. But to be fair, he's getting a bit of traction with it.
Exactly. Enjoy yourself, Chris. Enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
Now... Can we begin the postbags? We've got so much to get through.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
Further to... this is from Ben Thurston. Hello. Further to our conversations about the pools panels, I wonder if you turned your attention to spot the ball. My understanding of this was that, as it is illegal to bet on the event that has already taken place... What you're actually trying to do is not identify the position of the ball, but to replicate the guess of a panel of experts. The following extract is from a Guardian article from January 15th, At the time, no one had won the jackpot in over 10 years. This is the extract. Actually, what players are trying to do each week is not identify the factually correct whereabouts of the ball, but the whereabouts of a fictional ball determined by a mini-conference between two former players. So Liverpool's Ian Callaghan and David Sadler of Manchester United. How do they do that? Unfortunately, Callaghan answers the phone only to say that he doesn't want to talk and he doesn't have 5 minutes. Presumably, they don't actually meet up to decide. So, not only is there a Pools panel and a Dubis Goals panel, but there is a Spot the Ball panel as well.
This is blowing my mind.
Yeah, I knew that. You know, that's, yeah, so they're just... You're not guessing where the ball actually is. You're guessing where someone thought the ball would be.
So, according to this article, Ian Penrose, chief executive of Sports Texas, they do meet up every Saturday. They study a photo with the ball taken away. They sit and deliberate and decide where the ball... where the centre of the ball should be, and that's then marked with a pin. Deliberations take up to an hour. The process is unchanged in more than two decades. There you go. Matt Hamilton writes, "Hi, guys. Been listening to your many discussions of how Peter Shilton seemed to wait till the ball had gone in before choosing which way to go. But I think I've stumbled across a goalkeeper with an even worse technique. I was recently watching the 1982 World Cup semi-final that became the first World Cup match to go to penalties. French goalkeeper Jean-Luc Ettore faced six penalties. He only dived for one, and that was after the ball hit him. His technique seemed to consist of him staggering around the penalty area like a drunk, hoping he would somehow walk into the ball. Imagine only diving once. So he's not dived. He stayed... But stood.
Is he moving, though? Because there's a difference between staying static and the hope that one of them will be sort of hit down the middle or close enough to you, or doing that kind of Bruce Grobbelaar kind of like moving along the line in the hope that you might put them off.
Well, so what's the other option? Is that he's running to the side rather than diving? That wouldn't seem like the right thing to do, would it?
No, but do you know what I mean? Like, if he's constantly sort of taking a few steps either way, at some point the penalty taker has to take that penalty. And they've got the choice of going where they've chosen to go before his movement or waiting for him, a bit like an arcade game, and going, OK, he's moved far enough to the left now, I'm going to go to the right, which feels
Do you think, if you were allowed... I can't remember how the rules work. If you're allowed to move left and right on the line, do you think constantly moving side to side would be an advantage or a mistake? Like, if a goalie was... running from one post to the other. I suppose you're just trying to... You're trying to time it, like in a, like you say, in a computer game, trying to shoot at the right point.
I'd be interested to see it. I feel like there might be a differential in there because it is new and it is different. And I think certain players, they're already quite nervous, the psychology of it. They might overcompensate and shoot a bit further to the right, for instance, than they might normally and shank it or put it wide.
Are you constantly facing forward and kind of sidestepping? Or are you turning 90 degrees and pegging it between across. The posts?
I think you need to be sidestepping. I think you need to be able to sort of...
You're not
going to
get much of a pace up there, are you? Like, the pace is going to be slow enough that it's like, when you're on one side, you've got no chance of getting to the other. But if you just turn 90 degrees and are pegging it as hard as you can between the posts, suddenly it's a game changer.
I think the turning axis slows you down as well. And also, you're not committed to go to crab and sidestep all the way to each post. You could go a step and fake them and come back the other way.
Here's an idea, right? So you start and your position is a sprinter's kind of, you know, like at the start of the 100 metres, using one of the posts for your heel, right, to push off. So the whole goal is at the mercy, and you're in the corner, braced like a sprinter. And as the person runs up, you're gonna pounce off and you're gonna dive across the goal completely. And he's got to judge where would you position that kick? I think that'd be a difficult thing to play against.
I think you're right. I think that would be very unsafe. You wouldn't want to be the first kicker up against that technique, would you? Like, by the fifth one, you'd be like, okay, I've got a measure of this. I think the instinct is to go as far away as possible from the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But also, if he's started with any kind of momentum going forward, there's absolutely no way he can stop, turn around and respond if you've gone behind him. But also, I guess there'd have to be a sense that once a kicker starts his run up, he can't do one of those sort of like weird Jorginho staggered ones. There's a sort of like once the flag, you know, like a drag race. Once someone drops the flag, you're both going until the ball has been kicked.
But you know, there is kind of a precedent, isn't there? Because like Bruce Grobbelaar did the spaghetti legs in the European Cup final. Like that at the time was seen as really innovative and really consequential in terms of was it Roma they played, like, in terms of all those penalties that were missed. So, but mate, there is something in this. I think if you could innovate on the big stage, imagine the Euro final against Italy. Jordan Pickford is pegging it between the posts. You're going to be completely discombobulated as the penalty taker, right?
So imagine we've gone back in time, we're at the Euros, it's the finals, it's a penalty shootout. We're there in the fan park watching this. And Jordan Pickford starts doing that. Like, what's going through your mind?
I would honestly think he'd had such a good tournament. I was like, this is brilliant.
In his normal technique, he saved. The problem with it is, if you do that as a goalkeeper, the goalkeeper can't be the villain, except at the 1990 World Cup semi-final. But the goalkeeper can't be the villain. So if the goalkeeper was to do that, I feel like if it failed, they'd get a lot of flack.
But imagine if he saves the first one. imagine watching the heads go of the Italians in the semicircle.
Because also, you could do it from different posts. You wouldn't necessarily need to go left to right every time.
And also, if you're doing it for the first two, and on the third one you're static, you'll be like, what is this? What's going on now?
What about if you held onto the crossbar and kind of swung yourself left and right?
Like monkeys using the crossbar, like monkey bars.
Do you need to be on the line physically, or could Jordan Pickford, if he wanted, be stood on top of the crossbar? Which is, he's on the line directly.
He's on the line.
Yeah, he's on the line. And then his aim is to jump down the front. So the momentum of his fall.
I'm going to say that's probably the least effective of all the suggestions.
But what if he's like, you know, like how runners start for that 100 metres? They get down on like, they kneel down in the blocks. But he's in the very back corner of the net. So you're like, he's going to come charging out, but it's on what direction? Like, do you go for the far post? That appears like he's getting ready to sprint there. So like...
Yeah. Yeah, which direction he's charging at? Yeah.
Hey, it could work. It could work.
Okay, well, I should just end this correspondence with a very simple thing. Do you want to see... Do you remember when England toured Australia in 1991? I don't know if you remember this. They did some friendlies in 1991. Do you want to see a picture, a publicity picture from it? Do you like that?
Oh, wow.
What can you see there?
So that is Stuart Pearce sporting an incredible haircut. I had that haircut once as a kid, but it's because my mum couldn't afford it to take us to the hairdresser, so she just put a bowl on my head and just cut round the edges of the bowl.
Well, Stuart Pearce has the haircut of, you're right, of a school child, but no one's willing to say that to him.
Yeah. And he is stood next to Des Walker in what I assume are sort of official England tracksuits.
They don't look very official, do they?
They don't. They look like the sort of...
They look like...
Littlewood's catalogue.
Shell
suit tracksuits. And Stuart Pearce, the key detail is Stuart Pearce is cradling a kangaroo like a baby.
It's a beautiful picture, isn't it?
I didn't even spot the kangaroo. It blended into the tracksuit top.
What did you think the picture was? Just him.
I didn't know.
You didn't spot the kangaroo.
You talked about his hair. The kangaroo blends seamlessly into the tracksuit top.
I'm not sure it does.
No. I'd say if someone said, "What's that picture of?" I would definitely see the kangaroo.
Well, do you know where? Have you ever seen that? Sometimes they paint warships with this triangular like pattern that's not dissimilar to this one on this tracksuit, because apparently it's really difficult to pick up.
Yeah. It's a bit like the Manchester United it would work. Third kit.
And I never thought, well, that doesn't work. Here is the evidence. I didn't see a kangaroo amongst this pattern.
Oh well, there we go.
We'll get that on our Instagram.
If you want to get in touch with us, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Now, a legend of 90s football, if you do like the 90s, Then, Chris Skull, you have a book out about 90s football called what?
Can We Not Knock It? It's all in there. Lots of different games from the 90s that were looked at. Czech Republic once played Bamba Bridge in a Euro 96 warm-up. Read all about it. You can get a copy at canwenotknockit.com.
And if you like 90s culture, and frankly, why wouldn't you? Surely the dream Christmas present is that compacted into one present, or wrapped separately, with my book, Watching Neighbours Twice a Day, which is a journey through the 90s told through the TV shows we watched. Go and buy both of them. Here is a man who bestrode 90s television. Room 101, They Think It's All Over, Football Nightmares, The Outsiders, a documentary about following Iran at France 98, and of course, throughout it, was a huge fan of Stoke City, with a great story about being slammed by Stanley Matthews. This was a lovely chat with the brilliant Nick Hancock.
Today's guest is very much one of our dream guests. In the 90s, he combined hosting the iconic comedy panel show They Think It's All Over with dominating the VHS charts with his Football Nightmare series. It's our pleasure to welcome to Quickly Kevin, TV Titan and Stoke City fan, Nick Hancock.
How are you, Nick?
Very good, thank you very much. Just the ticket, yeah. Stoke not doing too badly, so that always helps. Pretty positive.
Are you emotionally involved? How emotionally involved do you get in Stoke City?
Yeah, less than I used to. I mean, I'll be honest. Since I've had children, not that I love my children more than I love Stoke. That's clearly not the case. It's confused things a little bit. I do get involved, but not in the same way that, you know, when you go to every single game and you live and breathe it, and you know, all you do the moment one game finishes, pardon me, is plan the next one, and not that bad, but you know, it still upsets me when they do badly, which is nearly all the time.
In the 90s was the kind of glut of the suddenly of the football fan, of the comedian or celebrity that be associated clearly with a club, and you were Stoke. And it felt like you were one of the ones that was the most kind of passionate about your club.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are different sorts of ways that worked, aren't there? Because first and foremost, you know, before 1990 and all that stuff, virtually nobody was willing to be associated with it. I was not a lone voice, but there are a lot of dilettantes out there. And I always say that if you meet somebody and they say this is what club, you know within 2 or 3 minutes if they support the club to the same level that you support the club.
Yeah.
You can tell easily.
Yeah.
Being Stoke's number one fan in the 90s, I'd say, what benefit did you see of that?
Oh, God, none. No, absolutely not. Because I used to just go with my mates the same way I always had. And of course, in the 90s, you know, the whole sort of executive box type thing, it only just kind of started. And it would have, being a Stoke fan, it would have seemed incredibly poncy to have done it. So not really. In fact, the only time I got to touch the hem of the coats of the influential people was when we won the Autoglass in 1992. And they... I'd just like to say we won it again in 1999. You know what I mean? It was our decade. They asked me to do a speech at the dinner afterwards.
Oh, wow. Now,
Josh, I don't know whether you've ever done a speech for professional sports.
No, people. I wouldn't want to.
Don't do it. You know, the comedian Bob Mills was asked to do cabaret for the England squad.
Yeah,
before a game, and died so badly he pretended to faint. He did, and he was sort of carried out. So, of course, similarly, I can tell that story because this is what happened to me. So I'm starting with the same sort of jokes I'd do if it was like my local football club, you know, taking the mickey out of them, saying, you know, that they're slow or they're this or they're that or they're the other. And of course, all professional footballers think that it's just bad luck that they're not, you know, the Ballon d'Or winner.
Yeah.
That there's no acceptance that possibly there's a grey area between, you know it's just a sort of an order. Anyway, so clearly all these jokes went down very, very badly. And then I just had a little hand on my shoulder, to the bloke sitting next to me. And he said, "I think you better sit down, son." And wait. And the bloke sitting next to me was Sir Stanley Matthews.
Oh, wow. Oh, no.
Very polite booing off, but by her peer of the realm.
Oh, wow.
So that
and
was,
did that ruin your day? You'd won the auto.
Did it ruin my day? I think about it constantly. I ended up, first of all, what happened is I did sit down and it sort of ended.
Yeah.
And then players came one by one to threaten me for the things I'd said to them, including the quite frightening Mick Kennedy, who was a member of that sort of incredible Portsmouth side with Noel Blake and all those sort of people. Yeah. And he was famous, and lots of threats and anger. And I ended up writing a letter to the club, to the players, and saying, I can't, yeah.
So can you not think about, maybe the ruin the day was the wrong phrase. Maybe I should put it this way. Can you not think about the 1992 Autoglass win with anything other than regret?
No, it's like going to see the total eclipse of the sun and looking straight at it. All I can remember is that blinding sense of failure and embarrassment and regret. No, that's all I see. That's all I see.
Oh, mate.
Yeah. You know, I smoked for quite a long time because they said that, you know, each cigarette takes a minute off your life. And I was hoping that I could choose the minutes that I could take off my life and I could go back to 1992 and take those minutes out of my life. So, yeah, that was the only privilege I had, the privilege to ruin my sense of self-esteem. Mate. Yeah,
you kind of alluded to the fact that in the 80s that being a football fan was very frowned upon. In the 90s, it suddenly became the ultimate accessory kind of thing. And I suppose, do you know, we hadn't written this down, but this just popped into my head. The defining thing that did that, maybe, is Italia 90. And you, of course, were in one of the defining texts of Italia 90, which was An Evening with Gary Lineker.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, An Evening with Gary Lineker was a play about watching the semi-final of the World Cup in a hotel in Mallorca. And Caroline Quentin was in it, and I was in it, Chris England was in it, and it was written by Arthur Smith and Chris England. And it wasn't a great leap to write this because I watched the semi-final of the 1990 World Cup in a hotel in Mallorca with Caroline Quentin, Arthur Smith, Chris England, and strangely enough, Bob Mills.
So wow.
Yeah. And indeed, Graham Souness, who was not in the same room, but was at the same hotel.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
This is like a seminal Sex Pistols gig, isn't it?
Kind of. Yeah, yeah. But of course, what then happened was we did the play in the West End, and it was great. It was a lovely thing to do because it was just your mates. And if the play gets written, you do it in a tiny hall somewhere and it ends up in the West End and it's written by your friends and I get to play a Stoke fan. So it was absolutely wonderful. And then before they went to Sweden, because of course it was the one where Lineker got taken off. Yeah, before they went there, the whole squad came to watch it. So in the West End. So that was quite nice. But Stuart Pearce wasn't there. And Chris, who wrote it, told me a great story about when it went on tour and they had a new cast. They did it in... they did it in Nottingham. Stuart Pearce came along to watch it. And at the end, there's a dream sequence where the penalties are being taken. And of course, they're going, and who's this? Who's it? It's Pearce stepping up to the ball. And of course, everybody in the theatre just turns around and looks at Stuart Pearce. And in the play, Pearce scores. And we go, and it's there, Pearce has scored. And Stuart Pearce stood up and went, yes, yes. In the theatre, which is very pleasing.
Oh, wow.
Because we normally start by saying, have you met a 90s footballer? But obviously with you, Stanley Matthews is not a 90s footballer in his 90s, maybe. But was there a kind of crossover between the comedy and the football world at that time?
No, not really, no. I mean, of course, it was easier to meet players then anyway, because, you know, they might do something other than sit at home playing, you know, Call of Duty. So, you know, there's half a chance you might see them somewhere. The ones that I met mostly were once they think it's all over, it started, because they would come on. Actually, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to persuade professional sportsmen, any professional sportsman, but especially footballers, to come on a show like that, because they live in a dressing room mentality, which means they're used to having the mickey taken out of them, but they also don't ever want to put their head above the parapet, because then you're the one that gets, oh, you did that on that program, you skipped. So, but we had some great people, and there were some very funny people around. So yeah, I mean, that was really lucky. It was just as a sports fan, what's not to like? You know, to meet all of your heroes and then be really rude to them.
Well, I was thinking about that, because your shtick was to be quite acerbic, a lot of mickey taking, but as you say, you know, you're relying on them getting the joke. Did it always come off, or did anyone come up to you afterwards?
What do you mean, as in like Mick Kennedy? Will Carling offered me out once. Well, it was more of a, you don't want to be saying that again, or you might find that something bad will happen to you, type thing, which is very funny. But mostly they do get the joke. They live in this incredible, predominantly male world where they get very, very bored and they just take the mickey out of each other, dead pigs in each other's lockers and stuff like that. So, if we go beyond the practical joke, they're kind of fine with it. And that was a great thing about having Lineker and Gow was, you know, if you're taking the piss out of probably the most famous footballer in the country at the time and probably the finest cricketer in the country at the time, then they're not really in a position to complain if you're taking the mickey out of them. Do you know what I mean? If somebody at the very top could say, no, this is fine, that it kind of helps.
Because I remember at the time, like, you were really in awe, not so much like on screen, but I remember in interviews and stuff, you David Gow was like your favourite sportsman. Because you're a huge cricket fan as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, yeah.
And so how quickly does David Gow stop being the person that I adored who was on the cricket pitch and become a kind of work colleague almost? Do you know what I mean? Or is he always David Gow?
I think almost immediately, to tell you the honest truth. Because the good thing about that, and I won't get into this too much, it's not something I really thought about, but in a sense, they're coming into your world.
Yeah.
So you're making them feel comfortable about what's going on. Not just the world of comedy, but the world of television to a large extent, the world of a panel show. So it's not like me going and having a net with him, you know what I mean? or playing five-a-side with Gary. It's not like that.
Would watch it, though. I would watch that.
And I would do it.
Let's talk about Stoke. So, because I think actually that is one of the things, is because you were so obviously a bona fide, a proper sports fan, I think that buys you a lot more as well. What were your earliest memories? You were born in 1962, so your earliest memories of supporting Stoke must be early 70s, would they be?
Very late 60s, early 70s. 69, 70 was the first season I went to a game. And I was thinking about this the other day, actually. I hadn't really probably seen that much football. There wasn't very much football on television. You know, it wasn't like you could have that sort of be blooded in your own home, that you could warm up for going to a game by watching lots of football.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It worked like that. Generally, your first experience was just rocking up. And, you know, I just remember my dad, I had my mate Phil around, and my dad said, what do you boys want to do today? Stoker at home, or we could go conker collecting at Shavington Gardens. I seem to remember the two options. And it's cost me a lot of money, but I chose to go to Stoke. I've never collected a conker since.
But there's a parallel world where you're one of the foremost conker collectors in.
Absolutely.
Doing a conker podcast right now. Yeah. So the late 60s is pretty good for Stoke. Did you see Gordon Banks play? He was signed that time.
Yeah, yeah. No, Gordon signed in 66, 67. I saw a lot of Gordon Banks. And in fact, I went to his last ever game, which clearly I didn't know was going to be his last ever game, because he had a car crash the next day.
Oh, God.
And it was away at Liverpool, which was not something I would normally probably have done at that age, because I'd only been about 10. 11, 12 maybe. And my dad said, come on, we'll go to Anfield to watch Stoke. And and tragically, next day he had his accident. So yeah, I got to see Gordon Banks, you know, and Jimmy Greenough, and Dennis Smith, and Alan Hudson, and those were all the players that were around at that time.
What's like your early day supporting Stoke? Was it very much like everyone would talk about Stanley Matthews? He played on until he was 50, but I think you would have just missed the tail end of his leg.
Yeah, he played until he was 51. In 1965, and of course he may well have played on another 5 years, but substitutes hadn't been brought in at that stage.
Right.
So it was pity he had to play 90 minutes, you know. so you can imagine, you say, well, give Stan another couple of years, he can come on for 20 minutes at the end, you know.
Yeah.
Because actually the interesting thing about, well, I think it's interesting thing about that was when Stan retired, we immediately bought Gordon Banks. And the reason was we'd made so much money out of playing friendlies because Stan played for us. You know, we were forever being asked to go to Real Madrid and Barcelona. And then we got Gordon Banks. And again, we were welcome in houses we should really have been welcome in.
So it's like when the kind of, you know, you see those news stories now about a club who've signed a Chinese player in the hope that it'll kind of break the Far East for them.
Gordon Banks. Yes. Well, yeah, I suppose kind of. You know, and Stan was from Stoke, so there was more of a logic to it. I think this was discovered rather than being the plan.
Yes,
but,
yeah.
You know, but it worked, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What was the match-going atmosphere like? What was the Victoria Ground like when you first...
Oh, right. Victoria Ground, we had a great big open end, which you had home fans and away fans in. Until about 10 minutes after kickoff. And then there's a big booth in there. The building stand, which was the new stand, which was built in, I don't know, 1950 something. And then the old stand, which is the Balustrade stand, which is where I first went. I used to go with my granddad a lot, and it was like wooden flooring, and you'd stamp your little feet, pardon me, you'd stamp your little feet to get the atmosphere going. So looking back on it, it was very much, you know, men with pipes all going along with this, but almost like a plume of smoke coming behind them, you know, and just little lads running around in between their legs and rickets, obviously.
And could you see, like, so not like as a small kid there, is it, were you in seats or were you...
Well, in the Butterstreet Stand, you're in seats, but when you used to go behind there, you know, your granddad or your dad would take a box for you to stand on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like carrying a box?
That was quite a common thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Like, when I started going to Argyle in the early 90s, it was still like terracing and you couldn't see and stuff. But it does feel like Stoke City in the early 70s is so divorced from your experience now of going to the Britannia. It must feel like two different clubs.
Well, it does, but of course, I mean, you age as well, don't you? And it's incremental, you know. I mean, the Premier League was a big step, but it kind of been incremental. I mean, I remember going to Plymouth many, many times and having a hairy walk across Home Park, trying to get back to the station and all those sorts of things. And indeed, I seem to remember playing there in the semi-final of the Watney Cup in 1974.
So what was the Watney Cup then?
The Watney Cup was for the highest scorers in each division.
So the top scorers of each division would play each other?
Yeah, in a kind of... And I seem to remember that Scotland might have been involved, but that might have been a different thing. So I think it was Hull, Plymouth, us, and whoever it was. So there's another trophy we've won.
So you won the last ever Watney Cup. Do you know what happened to the trophy after you'd won it? It's a great story. Yes.
Do you know? No, please.
Derby were the first. There's only four Watney Cups. Derby won the first. You won the last. But it was in Derby's trophy cabinet, and a Stoke fan saw it in Derby's trophy cabinet and said, hang on, we were the last winners. We should have it in our trophy cabinet. So now Derby and Stoke City share the trophy. They have it, yeah. They've got it on a timeshare essentially. So it could be right now. I don't know who's got it. But in 2019, it was in your trophy cabinet. Its whereabouts now is unknown. But
it's every other year, is it?
I assume so, yeah.
So in a sense, we win the Watney Cup every other year. We should have an open top bus coming from Derby. It's coming home, lads! Here we go!
It wasn't your only trophy. 72, you won the League Cup. Were you there?
Of course. I was there, yeah. March 4th. 1972, remember it very, very, very well. Stranger things you remember, because again, I was nine. And what the weird thing is, I remember going on the tube. I'd never been on the tube before. I'd never been to London before, in fact. But for some annoying reason, my biggest memory is getting on the tube, going back, and somebody going, Leeds have won 7-0. And that's my biking memory. Somehow, I don't know how it manages to be. It was a very famous game against Southampton, I think it was, when they were all doing keepy uppies and flicking the ball around.
Oh, yeah. I've seen footage of that, yeah.
It was that day, March the 4th, 1972.
In the semi-final, Chris is a West Ham fan.
Yeah.
You played West Ham four times, apparently, in the semi-final.
Yeah, yeah. We played, I think that season, I think I might say, we played something like 70 games.
Whoa.
Something ridiculous, because we had loads of replays in because we got to the FA Cup semi-final as well and had a replay in that, and we had a replay in the sixth round and we had a replay in the fifth round. We played Manchester United three times, so it was just game after game after game. Maybe the 70 games was Gordon Banks because he played for England as well, but yeah, it just went on. And I used to love replays. I rather miss them, but I can see why. And you know, and it probably seems a bit pointless to people now, but yeah, it was just so many games. It was incredible.
You were going home and away and stuff. So were you going to see all of these replays and stuff at that point?
Well, that was a little bit early for me. You know, these are school nights, aren't they? So,
yeah.
I mean, I went to Goodison for the FA Cup semi-final replay. I went to one or two of them. You know, if there were really big games and my dad desperately wanted to go, because obviously that's a great thing about the father-son thing is we both use each other as an excuse, obviously, for tickets all the time. In fact, my son did exactly that to me this year. He, because of all the COVID stuff, he hasn't been going to university, but he's been working from home. So he's saving up loads of money from his grant for his accommodation. So he says to me, we should be going to the Euro final, shouldn't we? And I said, yeah, but it's just silly. It's silly money. It's silly money. And he comes down, he goes, right, I bought us two tickets because I think you deserve to go, Dad. You know, you've been to all of these games, all of these disappointments. You deserve this. So I bought two tickets. So, of course, I want to be furious with him for spending the money. But, of course, it is kind of nice. And also, he's done the perfect thing. It's like when blokes used to go to sea, you know, young kids used to go to sea, and they get a tattoo, but they get mum. Because then mum would be cross about the tattoo, but secretly quite pleased about the fact it said mum on it. And it was the same thing with these tickets.
Back to the 70s. So your 70s pomp kind of ends. And this is one of my favourite facts about 70s football. It was like your great team of 70s essentially ends because of a storm in January 76.
Yes.
Right? The roof blows off your stand.
The roof blows off the stand and we have to sell Jimmy Green off to Manchester United. Yeah. Well... yes, it was. It happened to another club as well, I think. But very depressing. And then, of course, the finances were so, you know, hand to mouth in those days. The idea of insurance would probably be anathema to them. I don't know, but it's the same when you're a young kid. You just think, oh, that'll probably happen again in 10 years because I've been watching them for 10 years and now the roof's